This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to Chinatown.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't you introduce yourself?
So my name is Ryan. So I work for a media company called Pivot. It's a new Japanese startup. It was founded just 2 years ago. And we're focusing on entrepreneurs, technology, a lot of things, innovation, because in Japan, it's a time of changing and people are shifting from just working for an old company to working in a startup, changing their jobs. Yeah. So they're pivoting their lives.
Gotcha. Yeah. So let's take a step back. We had, the bubble in the 80s.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And then like a very, not super exciting 30 years. Mm-hmm. And then just a few weeks ago, we've got inflation back all of a sudden.
Right.
The stock market has finally reached its peaks from the late 80s and early 90s. Mm-hmm. And, you have all these like covers of The Economist being like, Japan's back.
Uh-huh.
So, I don't know. Why don't you give us the brief, the 30 years of history from the lens that you guys look at from a sort of technology and innovation perspective?
Sure. So before joining Pivot, I used to be the editor-in-chief of HuffPost Japan. Mm-hmm. And before that, I was the economics reporter for the Asahi, a newspaper company.
Mm-hmm.
So I covered economics, but everything was bad. It was all negative news. But right now, we're kind of producing all the positive content. And like you mentioned, we suffered the last 30 years of lost decades. And that suddenly changed. And there's several things because there's change in the mindset of the people. So instead of just going to a single company, staying there for a lifetime, people are creating their own jobs, starting their own company, switching jobs. And everything is changing in Japan.
Sure.
Especially after 2020 or 2021.
Sure. So, so what are the, maybe we'll start at the individual level and then build up to the companies.
Uh-huh.
So why are, I guess like traditionally in Japan, going back to the, post-war era, you had this like iron rice bowl type of a zaibatsu, whatever,
zaibatsu.
Uh-huh. And, what has led people to start to explore different, career paths?
I think, so there used to be a notion or myth that Japan is very bad at innovation because I remember Dr. Reischauer, who was the U.S. ambassador to Japan during the Kennedy administration, he famously quoted Japan kind of respects group interests before personal ones. And some people argue that since Japan, we produce rice, we're farmers.
Yeah.
So teamwork is important. So we are not...
Sure.
Yes.
Okay.
So we're not hunters going hunting for animals. So more than individuals, we kind of respect the group work. So that was like the myth. But I think it changed, the myths changed because especially after, after social media and internet, people began to speak out and use social media and, work on their own, start their own things. And that kind of changed the whole mindset of Japan. And also... Yeah. Before that, we tend to follow the United States in everything we do. But right now, we're beginning to rethink ourselves and rethink our identity and see which path we're good at.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I've just been reading this fascinating book called Mitsui Empire, which sort of tracks Mitsui like all the way from the 1630s to the 1970s. And, the idea that the Japanese aren't like, aggressive business people and can't innovate is just so absurd, where you have like, a firm started by a guy who was a samurai who decides, I don't want to be a samurai anymore. I want to go into business. Mm-hmm. And like the amount of sort of, inventiveness and sort of innovation that went into all those zaibatsu to grow them, both before World War II and then after World War II is really remarkable.
Yeah.
So like, it's kind of a ridiculous thing to say, but it is interesting you sort of talking about this mindset shift. Partially influenced by media of these, of sort of new paths being exposed.
Right.
I am sort of curious, to what extent it was also like a function of people being forced into it, where I remember reading some stats about like the amount of people who ended up kind of getting in the system of these sort of tracks, whether it's within government or within like Sony or Fujitsu or whatever, being a much smaller percentage of the population than you were looking at in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
So I think the people who were in the big companies were like the leaders, and they're like the symbols of the Japanese economy. So when you go into a company and stay there for a lifetime, they were like the role model of the Japanese career. And also, not because of only the system, but not because of the law, but there's kind of social pressure to stay and stick to one company. So there's a funny term called yome block in Japanese, which means spouse block.
Okay.
So so whenever some people try to quit a company and join a startup, your spouse blocks you. So that was kind of a social kind of pressure that you should not go, you should not take risks, or you should not go to new companies. So that was that's also changing.
Yeah. So one of the dramatic trends over the past decades has also been more women in Japan entering the workforce. You know, to what extent is like having, you know, two incomes in a family enabled one of the partners to be more ambitious, risk taking with their careers?
That you made a good point, because I personally don't like the word yome block, because there's a notion that your spouse is your housewife and it's only the man that's working. So that's also changing. Gender role, gender equality is also changing. So I think that's one of the big shifts we're experiencing right now.
Gotcha. Yeah. Why don't you, can you put some numbers around these trends that you've been talking about?
Right. So starting from 2022, the Kishida administration, the prime minister, is spending 1 trillion yen on startups, which is about 6 to 7 billion US dollars. So there's a tremendous amount of money pouring into startups. So there's a lot of companies going around. But at the same time, when we look at the stats, it's not really changing yet, because the opening rates of the Japanese firms, for instance, the number of companies starting within a year, it's only like 5%. And so curious, it's funny that during the 1970s, it was 10%. So there were more companies, new companies 20 or 30 years ago, but right now it's only 5%. So there's still zombie companies that are not replaced by new ones. So we kind of see the trend happening, but it's not reflected on the starts yet. It's just money pouring in and also the media talking about it. So we need to maybe take 5 or 10 years to see the stats changing.
Gotcha. Yeah. So, you know, one of the other exciting developments in the Japanese economy has been corporate governance reform.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about what the problems were with corporate governance reform, as well as, you know, what the changes that you've seen over recent years are potentially unlocking, both for, you know, established firms as well as potentially new entrants?
So before the reforms, the Japanese companies were not innovative. So they were not spending money on R&D and innovation. And also, because of the strict corporate group culture, there was a certain bank and a certain company being together. So it was not, there was not competition, but that changed. And people were introducing corporate governance, and it totally changed the Japanese culture. So they're more open to CEOs from the outside, or open to outside markets. And there's a lot of pressure from the Tokyo Stock Exchange to change that and change that, change that. And the companies just changed, because I think they're changing the age of CEOs. Instead of like CEOs in 60s or 70s, they're more younger CEOs. So I think that drove change and brought in money to the stock market. And that led to the Nikkei high of 400.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard if you're like a company and your main supplier you happen to own 30% of.
Right.
It's like, you're not going to really think about this new startup who's maybe more efficient or whatever if like you are like very much invested in the company that you buy from to get your material or your services or whatever. So it's really interesting. Like, how has the Tokyo Stock Exchange, what role have they as an institution and their leadership played in like forcing these companies to modernize?
So they put like strong pressure on companies.
Okay. Like how?
So if a company is not, so if it's not efficient, they like name and shame that company and tell them to change.
Yeah, that's it's really funny. And like a lot of these firms, right, they're just sitting with cash in their balance.
Right.
Like the debt levels of these firms, I guess because they're kind of, it's like a historical, they've also, you know, been scared over the past 40 years. you know, are, you know, can give out dividends, right, can invest more in R&D. Uh-huh. And it's been very funny to watch the Tokyo Stock Exchange, yes, CEO just like be mean to these firms.
Yeah, they're so mean, yes. And not only the stock exchange, but the startup culture. So this is the big impact of the startup culture, because since a lot of companies are being on the news, and people would want to join that company. So Sony, Toyota, they were afraid that they would lose the talented people. Mm. If they won't change, the talented people will go to startups. So I think the startups put pressure on the big companies and they kind of change in a way.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this idea of like lateral hires, right, younger, not seniority-based promotion,
yes,
is like a pretty foreign one for these, right, these big firms, mm-hmm, right?
Because I used to be in a very traditional company, Asahi, and I left.
Yeah.
So if Asahi didn't want me to leave, I don't know if they wanted to, but they have to change and they'll lose people.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So yeah, let's talk about some companies. Like, yeah, what are the big names people are really excited about nowadays?
So Sony, they had a strong reform. And also Mercari, have you heard of Mercari?
Explain.
So Mercari, they kind of, it's like an exchange platform for used items. So if you have like your clothing or books, you sell on Mercari. And there's
this is a global platform, right?
It's a global
platform. Yeah, okay. Yes. I've seen ads for it on the subway.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And also BizReach. Mm-hmm. It's a company to match people from, like, if you want to seek a job, it's a matching site for it. So that kind of reflects the change in Japan, because people are going to BizReach and find new jobs and switch jobs.
Yeah.
It's a big company in Japan.
You know, what are the sectors where you're seeing the most startup growth?
Or
investor interest?
Investor, right now, at the moment, I think science is big in Japan.
Really?
Yes. Hard science, like life science and also nuclear science and all those stuff.
Why is that?
I think, so in the 2010s, a lot of startups tried to build a new app. They wanted to be the next Facebook, next Google, next Apple, next Amazon. But right now, since the Magnificent Seven are so dominant, people are right now focusing on something Japan is good at, and which is, I think, science and technology.
Hard tech is a theme that we've explored on China Talk for a while. And, mm-hmm, you know, there's a lot of, it's a very challenging thing to invest,
yes,
in, because like the companies take a lot longer to grow. You, mm-hmm, have this, you know, valley of death challenge. Mm-hmm. Is this something, you know, you mentioned the Kishida administration is very excited in putting money into it.
Mm-hmm.
How are they thinking about investing from a sort of like a sectoral perspective with the government capital going into new firms? Mm-hmm. It's like, how does that work? Like, who runs that money? What are their priorities? Mm-hmm. Like I think people have a sense of sort of Medi and industrial policy from a historic sense, but, mm-hmm, less so how Japan is going, the Japanese government could directly, mm-hmm, play in a startup economy.
That's a very excellent question, because some pundits are arguing that, you know, governments are not good at choosing which business will succeed.
Sure.
So people argue that instead of a government just putting money on certain industries, they should like cut regulations before, so using the budget to cut regulations, or maybe changing the whole system so they can do their own things. So I think from right now, we have to choose that $1 trillion of money to which section Kishida should put on, or maybe he should, or the government should not choose this industry, but use the money in a different way to like cut regulations and change the whole system. So I think that's a very difficult question.
Gotcha. Yeah. So right now he's just announced he wants to spend this money, but it's not clear.
Yes. And all the government sector is trying to reach out and say, we want this money, we want,
yeah,
this
budget. The life science people, yes, give, yes, it to,
yeah,
me.
Yeah, give it to me. Or yeah, tech people, tech is important, or, you know, human resource sector, we are important, like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, one of the really dramatic, mm-hmm, things that our listeners are probably familiar with is the CHIPS Act.
Yes.
The sort of like $10 billion, mm-hmm, almost, that has gone,
yeah,
both to TSMC and I guess Sony as well by, mm-hmm, proxy in Kumamoto,
yeah,
as well as Rapidus.
Yeah.
What was the sort of motivation behind that? Can you talk a little bit about the execution, and then maybe we'll come to Rapidus afterwards?
Right. So it's kind of a discussion of the Japan is back discussion, because, you know, in the 1970s and 80s, we're leading the computing world and semiconductor, but because we talked about the last decades and we were losing confidence But because all the economic security and all the circumstances changing, suddenly Japan became the center of the world on semiconductors. So I think it was a very big momentum for Japan to create, you know, TSMC has their own factory in Kumamoto and also Rapidus has in Hokkaido. Mm-hmm. So people are saying that it's one of the reasons Japan is back. We can win again on semiconductors.
Yeah, mm-hmm. No, it is remarkable, mm-hmm. like just how much faster the factory in Kumamoto has been able to set up, how much faster the Japanese government was able to get the money out to TSMC versus the CHIPS Act and sort of the local governments in Arizona and Ohio that have really struggled to get all the permits and whatnot. But, fingers crossed that'll come through soon. So I think, Kumamoto is a relatively straightforward thing. Uh-huh. They gave a lot of money to TSMC and now they're building a fab. Uh-huh. What the hell is Rapidus?
So it's called a Kokusan Kigyo. So it's government-backed up company, it's translation is that. So the government is spending so much resources, so much money, human resources, and trying to build that company that will bring Japan back into the center of the world. So it's half business, half government policy and international security.
Yeah, and so the ambition, right, is to create leading-edge logic.
Yes, absolutely.
And, they're promising a 2-nanometer chip.
Yes, which is very challenging, and I doubt that they'll happen. Yeah.
But it's also this partnership with IBM,
yes,
right?
Yes,
Okay. Mm-hmm. Some folks have on my trip have been like, why the heck did they choose Hokkaido? Who wants to live there? Like, it's really cold.
It's a nice place. You can if you like skiing, it's Hokkaido. It's great.
Okay, yeah. But I mean, it is an interesting decision because people talk about regional clusters,
yes.
right?
Uh-huh.
And deciding to invest your semiconductor money at one corner of Japan and then on the other corner of Japan is it's a tricky decision,
right?
Uh-huh. Is this like a politics thing where you want to make sure you got the Kyushu and then the Hokkaido politicians happy? Like, what do you think the dynamic is with that?
So there's no meaning to separating the two, but there's several angles to it. One is water, because you need water to make good semiconductors, and Kumamoto has good water. Mm-hmm. And also, in the context of local economy, since if you look at the Japan island, it's very, long. And the last decades have not impacted only the Tokyo economy, but also in the rural Asian region. So Hokkaido, Kumamoto, Kyushu Islands, they really want a good company to come to their place.
Mm-hmm.
Because after the Lehman Brothers shock in 2008, a lot of companies left Kyushu or Hokkaido or Nagoya.
Mm-hmm.
So the local economy is very disrupting right now. So if they can invite global companies to their own region, it would create jobs, the city will be filled with population. So I think one of the reasons Hokkaido and Kumamoto really wanted that company, the big companies, is because to boost the local economy.
Let's talk about demographics.
Yes.
I think that's the one thing that people are sort of like worried about on the horizon for the future of the Japanese economy. Mm-hmm. What's your take?
So what's your impression of Japan? Old people?
I don't know. I mean, we're sitting here in Harajuku, right?
You see
a lot of kids.
If you go to other places of Japan, we're a very old country.
Yeah.
So a lot of things, there's kind of a divide between the young people and the old people. So I think the social divide will be a very huge social issue in Japan in like 5 or 10 years.
Mm.
And also about social security and also welfare. I think Japan's spending so much tax money, taxpayers' money onto, the hospital and also the medical bills. So I think that will be a huge issue. We talked about startups, but it's a trend happening only in the young generation.
Yeah.
And some people in the old generation don't understand that trend. So I think there will be a divide. But at the same time, maybe there will be an innovation within the aging society, for instance, healthcare innovation, and so on. So they're both sides to that.
Why don't people want to have kids?
I think it's a same phenomenon happening in all developed countries. So number one is because of the economic conditions. If you have kids, it will take education money. People are not, they can't afford to have like 2 or 3 kids. So that's one reason. And also because of, we talked about gender issue. So I took a parental leave when my son was born, and I was kind of attacked by people that men should not take care of their child. So there's kind of a social notion that if you have a child, it's the woman who has to take care of it. So I think that needs to change. And people are not uncomfortable having a kid because it's changing in Japan right now, but there's still social norms that if you have a child, the mother has to take care of it. It's changing.
Yeah. What is there to be done? I don't know. Like, presumably this is something that people are trying to change at the margin, right?
Yes. Uh-huh. And also child care system. It's very hard. If you live in like Tokyo metropolitan area, it's very difficult to find a place where you can leave your child in a safe place. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, are there government policies that they're trying to do to change the dynamic?
Yes, a lot. Yes. Mm-hmm. But so it's very hard to change. These things, the change doesn't happen like one day. So the government is heavily investing on that policy, but I think the change will happen like 5 or 10 years later.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the sort of like tech media landscape in Japan. I mean, you guys as a startup have decided to go all video.
All video.
You know, what is the sort of, I don't know, how do you make money as a tech media outlet here in Tokyo?
So we do a lot of sponsored content and we work with companies and even governments to make videos for them to promote their products or promote their visions. And that's because instead of companies going to like ad agencies to put like commercials on TV, they realize that commercials are not working. So they pick up the phone and come to us and we create videos for them because that's one of the best ways to promote their visions, idea, products.
Gotcha. Yeah. How's legacy media doing in Japan?
They're doing not good because it's because of the ads. And so we have a very different view of ads. So I work for a newspaper company, so I know that the idea is that the newspaper or the media gathers the audience and put the ads and people see the ads and the clients will be happy. And as opposed to our system, we kind of create the ads together with the company.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, like in the US, we basically had local media kind of die.
Yes.
And, you know, all that's left really is like the New York Times and then billionaires who want to support other legacy media. Mm-hmm. You know, with the sort of major Japanese sort of politics and economics outlets, like, are they also having to cut staff and whatnot? What's the dynamic there?
So cutting staff is a very controversial issue in Japan. So you're not supposed to cut staff because that's the last thing you should do.
Okay.
So, but the Asahi is starting to cut people, which is a very big thing in Japanese culture because Asahi, on the editorial side, they're writing articles that the company should not cut their staff.
Yeah.
But they're doing that on their own right now. So I think that's a big change. And one of the reasons the newspapers have survived so far is because of the distribution system. So instead of people buying paper on newsstands or like buying from a newspaper company, there's a subscription model and you can buy Asahi for 1 year and they just give Asahi.
Yeah.
And a lot of the old generations, if they have a new house or they move to a new house, you know, you contact your electricity company, your cable TV company, and also you contact the local newspaper. So it's like the, you know, preset thing.
Sure.
So that was the reason newspapers survived in Japan. But at the same time, that's changing and people have to realize to make money instead of just the subscription model, but on digital, and it's not working in Japan. So because Asahi is not like the New York Times, it's a very general newspaper. We don't have a global brand image.
Yeah.
So the Japanese population is shrinking and nobody's reading a paper. So there's a very difficult challenge, more difficult than the United States.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think the one outlet that maybe listeners of this show will be most exposed to is Nikkei. Excellent China
of
coverage
course.
In particular.
Yes. Uh-huh.
They seem like they're not going to die anytime soon. I don't know. I'm a paying subscriber.
I'm curious, do you think Nikkei's China coverage is very good from the lens of the United States?
It is. Uh-huh. Sometimes it's great. Sometimes it's awful. Mm. So they have a handful of columnists one or two guys in particular that just write gossip as if it's real. But you know, the stuff that I read about the Chinese economy or Chinese technology is really excellent.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm presuming they're just translating stuff from their Japanese reporters into English. So, mm-hmm. yeah, shout out to Nikkei.
Okay.
I think they're doing a good job.
Okay.
Cool. So yeah. I guess one other question I want to ask about is Twitter in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's like after the US, like the most important market mm-hmm. for the company.
Yeah. People are always on Twitter in Japan. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, I don't know, what's like Twitter culture like in Japan? Is there anything different people should know?
So when you look at the stats, 70% of Twitter users in Japan are anonymous. So they don't use their real names.
Mm.
And that kind of fits the Japanese culture of it's very difficult in Japan to expose yourself and, you know, say your own name. And also after the earthquake in 2011, the Tohoku tsunami earthquake, Twitter was like the very best infrastructures to keep in touch with your friends and family and show which part of the area is dangerous. So it was a different, the Twitter kind of added a different context. It's not just only social media for fun videos, but an infrastructure to save people's lives.
Gotcha.
So that was a big phenomenon in Japan. So people kind of have the image that Twitter, you know, the society needs Twitter. But at the same time, I think this is a global issue, but there are a lot of fake news, disinformation, you know, bad stuff, especially after Elon Musk.
I'm really curious how this plays out in like another language mm-hmm. because look, in the US, like you had presumably like I guess Elon pre-Twitter, you had a lot of investment in like, you know, safety people and public policy
yes.
people
uh-huh.
and screening or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And on English language Twitter at least, uh-huh. look, we've seen like Elon let Nazis come back on the platform uh-huh. and there's just like a lot more bots and a lot
yes.
more
uh-huh.
sort of mess.
Uh-huh.
Is that also playing out in the Japanese ecosystem as well?
It's same. And we have a lot of bots, very messy. But I think the one thing I should point out is that Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, they're all a U.S. company.
Mm.
So we have Twitter Japan or Facebook Japan, but they're like just...
It's like 10 people,
yeah,
right?
Not 10 people, but just a place for business. So yeah. Whenever a government official or even a user wants to contact Twitter and say something to Twitter that you should change this or you should... It's bad for you. We don't know how to contact them because it's all in the United States.
Yeah.
So in terms of not national security, but we don't have control of the social media, even if it's affecting the Japanese space. So
yeah.
I think that's a very big problem. So even before Elon Musk, the Japanese people are not comfortable about Twitter, fake news and all the mess, but there is nothing we can do about it because it's a U.S. company.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So it's getting worse, but it's kind of the same.
Yeah, because there was always this sort of lack of agency, regardless of who was the
right.
CEO.
Yes, it was funny because I was having a conversation with a U.S. reporter who covered Instagram, and she said that she gets a lot of like emails from Japanese users that tell Instagram this.
Here's the problem.
Because the Japanese user had nowhere to contact Instagram.
Yeah.
So they decided to send an email to a reporter.
So, like, yeah, I guess what are the things, are there, like, recent scandals or, like, what are things that people have been frustrated with?
Not scandals, but a lot of, you know, fake news or people affecting mental health. And there are also some even celebrity committed suicide. And also about the I'm worried about the young generation because, you know, not only Twitter, but Instagram and so on. People go on to social media, they compare their bodies to their friends,
yeah.
and that affects their mental health. So I think it's a huge problem, but there's, like I said, there's nothing we can do about it. There are a lot of discussions in the Japanese government, and also especially the city of Kawasaki. There are a lot of Korean Japanese living in Kawasaki, mm-hmm. and there are a lot of hate news. So Kawasaki pulled a bill that we should be strong on hate speech. So I once talked with a lawyer who's working in Kawasaki. So he's like gathering all tweets and deciding which tweet is the hate speech. But after that, it takes so much longer because they have to contact the Twitter headquarters and, you know,
yeah.
maybe they won't look at emails from Kawasaki, Japan.
Yeah, no, that's mm-hmm. that's really tough.
Yes.
So
you guys can like invite Mark Zuckerberg into your Congress and
yeah.
you know tell him to do this, but... There's no political power for Japan.
Well, it's interesting because mm-hmm. the EU's kind of tried to do
that's
that,
true,
right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And I guess it's just like Japan doesn't want to be that obnoxious. Mm-hmm. Or why haven't you seen more aggressive regulation along the lines of what the EU has tried to do?
I think lack of public discussion, because still in Japan, we talked about TikTok on our show, but TikTok is a fun thing in Japan still yet. Mm-hmm. So some experts are writing reports about the dangers of TikTok, but at the moment, TikTok is fun thing. We should, you know, business people should use it. So there's lack of public discussion.
Yeah, but I guess beyond TikTok, like, look, in the EU over the past few years, you've seen more and more aggressive efforts to kind of bully the Western Western firms when it comes to like this Apple antitrust thing, Google $1 billion fines here and there. But you don't see that sort of news coming out of Japan. What gives in that perspective?
But I think there's mixed feelings towards like Google, Apple, and Facebook and Twitter. So there are kind of a negative thing for our society, but at the same time, because we talked about the lost decades of Japan, the narrative in Japan is like this, you know, we should be like Twitter, we should be like Facebook and break things and be innovative.
Okay.
So that was like the main narrative in the 2010s. So we kind of respect the social media companies. So I think maybe in the 1 or 2 years, there'll be a change in the Japanese discourse and to be more aggressive towards social media. But at the same time, we kind of have a mixed feelings towards the big tech companies.
That's super interesting. Let's close by talking a little about AI.
Yes.
I don't know. What's AI's reception in Japan? You tell me where to start.
AI, so ChatGPT is a very big phenomenon in Japan. And there's also a AI company in Japan called Sakana AI. So the concept is like bringing small bits of AI and to compete with the big AIs. What's interesting is, have you heard of the anime called Doraemon?
Yeah.
Doraemon is a huge thing in Japan. So. Yeah. So my opinion is that Doraemon is different from the Terminator.
Okay.
So we are friends with robots. So we need to be critical against AI and think about the ethics. But at the same time, I think Japanese people are kind of comfortable working with AI or having AI as your family or your friends.
Yeah.
So there is a study in Japan that tells that if we have more AIs in a company, people will not actually lose their jobs, but people become friends with AI and be more productive.
Yeah.
So I think that's a weird part of Japan. Maybe in the future, the Western worlds will be afraid of AI, people will lose jobs, but Japanese will be opposite and be friends with AI and maybe people will be productive because it's an aging population. Yeah. We have less workforces. So maybe Japan needs AI to maybe take care of the elders also.
Yeah, there's already full employment, right? So like you need any help you can get from a productivity perspective.
There's a saying in Japan that we need a cat's help because we're so busy. We need the help of cats. Same time, we need the help of AI right now. So that's a different circumstance in Japan.
Gotcha. Last question. Immigration, another topic that
very tough.
People are hoping to, you know, think that Japan will need at one point or another. I don't know. It's been interesting walking around here and, and you know, I guess I've heard Japanese being spoken behind counters and there's like a South Asian immigrants, a handful of them, it seems. But what's the politics and trajectory of Japan and immigration
so
policy?
It's a very difficult conversation. And I think that we need to open our market or open the world more and have more immigrants. But there are a lot of discussion or pundits that say that that will ruin the Japanese society. And maybe 10 years ago, such discussion was like held by like right-wing extreme people. But in the world we live in today, such discussion are like, kind of gaining popularity because the Japanese people are seeing what's happening in the United States and Europe, that it's very important to like have immigration. It's very important to have diversity in a society, but it's also causing a lot of problems. So some people are not just the crazy people, right-wing people, but, you know, liberal people are also kind of thinking that we need to limit the number of immigration. So we need immigrations, but there's discussion that, no, who should we invite? Who should we not?
All right. So we end every China Talk episode with a song. What is a Japanese song that captures the, I don't know, optimism, future tech?
I have Creepy Nuts. Have you heard of them? They're like a rap group, two people, and they're like popular on YouTube.
Okay.
And on Spotify, I believe they reached number one in the world ranking.
Okay.
So it's funny that 10 years ago, Japanese people listened to foreign music, U.S. music, like Taylor Swift or something. Mm. But there, the statistics shows that people are listening more to Japanese music. Mm. And Japanese musicians, instead of just selling their music to the Japanese market, they're going overseas because of K-pop.
Wow, okay.
So the Creepy Nuts, they're extremely popular in Japan. But since there's a they're using U2 as a promotion. And also, have you heard of YOASOBI? So YOASOBI, Creepy Nuts. So they're going, like, from day one, they're thinking about expanding globally. And gosh, that's a big change in Japan. So in Japan, people used to only listen to, the market used to be very closed, but that right now is opening a market and people are going outside. And that's one of the change we're seeing, that, you know, music or Otani, people are going global. Now it's the business turn to go global.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being a part of China Talk.
Thank you so much. It was really exciting.
Thank you.